It's 4:06. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. When Bill de Blasio is sworn in as the mayor of New York City shortly after midnight tonight, he becomes the 12th of 12 Democrats to rule the United States' largest cities. 12 years ago, only half of those cities were run by Democrats, indicating some kind of shift there in voter trends. Why? Why that change? My next guest explains what might be behind the trend toward Democratic leadership. He's Mark Niket, state and local government reporter for Bloomberg News. Mark, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
So what is with the change? It used to be about 50-50 in the top 12, the 12 biggest cities in the country. Now all Democrats running those. What has happened?
Well, a couple of things are going on. One is demographics. You've seen a shift in the folks living in the most populous cities. They've become more democratic with more immigrants moving into cities and younger folks tending to move into cities. But you've also had sort of a shift in the issues that matters to the voters in the biggest cities. Used to be 20 years ago, crime was one of the dominant issues, which is why you saw mayors like Rudy Giuliani in New York take to the fore. And today, the issues are a little bit more towards equality, whether it's an income or housing or other types of issues. Those tend to appeal more to or favor Democratic candidates, or at least those are the issues that the voters tend to care more about.
Yeah, you had this paradox where a place like New York City, a massive Democratic city, disproportionately Democratic, electing Republican mayors, or, you know, Michael Bloomberg, who was kind of all over the place, Republican, independent, but not a Democrat.
Right. And you have now the new mayor, Mayor de Blasio, taking office, and he ran on a very progressive platform where he made income inequality the centerpiece of his campaign, promised to raise taxes on the wealthy to help pay for education programs, have more equitable housing. So he sort of really represents this idea of a true Democratic kind of candidate looking to address the income inequality and appealing to voters who live in the cities today.
A couple of surprises in the top 12, or maybe surprising, I don't know. Texas, a very Republican state, yet its big cities, places like Houston, Austin, which is bigger than I had thought. I didn't know it was in the top 12 until I checked it out today. Democratic mayors there. Why are there these Democratic islands in a big Republican state?
It's just kind of how it's evolved. In Texas, we thought, was a good example for that very reason. You have, and it's even described that way in Texas, sort of these sea of red surrounded by the blue islands of the big cities. And it's sort of where, you know, folks have chosen to live. You have, you know, folks who have in some cases moved out of cities into the suburbs or rural areas who might be more Republican or conservative. And we wrote a story that sort of highlighted, you know, what this meant in the big picture. And Texas is a good example because you have a state that is run at the state level by Republicans. You have a Republican governor. All the statewide offices are held by Republicans. Legislature is run by Republicans. And yet you have these big cities run by Democrats. And in some cases, that creates conflict between the issues that are focused on. At the state level, you might have issues that are more appealing to the conservative rural areas of the state, since the Republicans are in control, which run counter to maybe what the cities want. An example of that might be Medicaid expansion, where this is an issue the cities really want to see take place because it's in the best interest of their residency and they believe in it. But the state politicians who control the power don't want to see that for ideological and other reasons. So Medicaid expansion doesn't go forward in a state like Texas, even though the folks in the biggest cities would want it.
You point toward number 13, the 13th biggest city in the country, Indianapolis, as being the biggest one run by a Republican mayor. Is there something different there, or have they just not caught up with this trend yet?
Well, if you talk to the mayor of Indianapolis, Greg Ballard, and we did for this story, he talks a lot about how the Republican Party nationally is a little bit out of step with what folks in the cities care about. And he talks a lot about how if you're going to focus a lot on ideology, for example, that's not going to play very well in a city where people want their mayor to get things done, take care of the trash, plow the snow, do the things that you expect in terms of city services. So in his view is you govern much more pragmatically, and the Republican Party nationally needs to pay more attention to cities and approach issues, more with a bent on getting things done in a way that mayors are sort of forced to, regardless of your political party.
Do you think he's right? Do you think voters care more about competent or incompetent versus Republican or Democrat when they're electing a big city mayor?
I think there's a difference when you're electing a big city mayor versus a president. I think at that level, you do care more about, well, who's going to solve my problems? Who's going to be the best person to get the everyday things I need done at the city level? And I think you're more inclined, or a lot of voters at least are inclined, when they're electing a president or a governor, to think, well, is this person more along the lines of my point of view or my issues, the things I care about in terms of ideology?
It seems like being a governor or in Congress or the Senate maybe is a big springboard to a high national political profile. Are we looking at these city mayors, these Democratic big city mayors, as people who might move on to a statewide level or run for the White House someday?
Potentially. And the Democrats talk about how their quote-unquote farm team, the folks, like you say, who might be in a position to run for higher office later, are in the cities. And they're being featured prominently on the national stage. One of the mayors pointed out to me, again, as a difference between the Democratic and Republican Party approach, that at the Democratic National Convention, you had big city mayors featured pretty prominently, including Mayor Castro of San Antonio, who's the keynote speaker of the convention. And at the corresponding Republican convention, mayors were really nowhere to be found, or at least weren't given prominent roles. So you do have these sort of big city mayors emerging as stars or rising stars in their party, and you might see them trying to move on to the national stage here in the coming years.
Is the Republican Party less interested in the mayoral seats, more focused on government, governors and Congress?
Well, I think it's evolved that way. There was a real push on the part of the Republican Party, for example, to gain control of state houses and governor's office in 2010, and they were successful. The Republicans have increased their control of state houses across the country since then. And you'll hear complaints from some of the Republican mayors, including the Republican mayor of Mesa, Arizona, who serves as the president of the U.S. Conference of Mayors this year, saying that, you know, they sort of not focused enough on the cities, that, you know, from a Republican perspective, sure, it's fine to get more control of governor's office and state houses. There's real power there. But they can't ignore the cities because it's a big population base. And I think the feeling is, you ignore the cities at your peril, that, again, one, you lose a big voting bloc, but also if you can't appeal to the folks at the city level and address at least some of the issues they're concerned about, that's going to affect you in statewide and national elections down the road as well.
Based on the research you did for the story, the people you talked to in politics around the country, do you think this is a trend that's going to continue, Democratic mayors of big cities?
I think it will, as long as you see at the national level the focus on the issues that we see today. And again, if you see the Democratic Party focusing much more on social inequality and income disparities, those, again, are going to be issues that I think appeal more to Democrats and will help Democrats in big city mayor races. And if the Republican Party is focused more on social issues or opposing issues of equality, I'm thinking of minimum wage type debates that we're seeing happening around the country now, for example. Again, I think that tends to hurt Republican candidates trying to run at the city level, because again, if the voters might even like the Republican candidate, if the candidate is associated with a Republican ideology that the voter doesn't agree with, that could affect the candidate's chances in a big city mayor's race.
Mark, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
That's Mark Niquette. He's a state and local government reporter for Bloomberg News. Coming up, the WPR News team takes us on an audio tour of 2013 in Wisconsin, and then our guest columnist makes the case for the four-day work week. First, here's a look at headlines with Kristen Durst. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Debate over a proposed northern Wisconsin mine topped the list of stories covered by Wisconsin Public Radio news reporters this year. But there were a lot of other major topics as well, from permits for the state capitol rotunda protests to health care, a major forest fire, a nuclear plant showdown, wolves, mascots, and ice-covered loons. For a listen to the best and most interesting of our 2013 sound bites, we'll take a tour in this roundup from the Wisconsin Public Radio News team.
This is the first step and the rebirth of the mining industry.
The obliteration of a headwaters in a watershed system is catastrophic.
This here is the LCO Harvest Camp here. We're under our 1842 treaty rights to harvest and gather here.
The first night we froze butt.
We're building a little wigwam right there. Pretty nice here.
Attention in the Capitol. This is the State Capitol Police Chief David Irwin. I have determined that your group or event does not have the required permit.
There's a degree of arrogance here on the part of the university. They all think they're PhDs and we ought to be working at a Jiffy Lube. Well, that's not the way it works. The legislature's a heck of a lot smarter than they're giving us credit for.
I hear the angst. I hear the anger.
The mountains of women now that are regretting these abortions, you know, when it became popular in the 60s and it was almost the thing to do, you needed to get one of them to be a woman.
You're interrupting a roll call. Sit down. Right now.
This is a shameful day in this body. Shameful. And they are going to be hurting women all across this state.
Everything changed and all this heroin started coming around and people, it was almost like their drug addiction started all over again.
There is $10 billion of federal funding that would come into Wisconsin over the next 10 years if the governor and the legislature chose to expand Medicaid.
Well, there are some people that have gone online and been able to get through the entire process flawlessly. Others have not had that same experience.
Sean Duffy's Tea Party shutdown could weaken the economy and devastate middle-class families.
When Ted Cruz was out there talking about how this is such a great strategy, defund Obamacare, I was on MSNBC and other stations saying, that's stupid.
You can see how we aggressively get on our path to help the people of the state create 250,000 new jobs.
The glaring omissions and revisionist history in this dishonest book indicate he is clearly intimidated by the truth.
Hard Rock Kenosha. I like the sound of that. I really do.
At 7:41 this morning, operators in control room at Kewaunee began the process of reducing output from the station.
This is huge, and it's a huge impact, and many of these people have been in the employ of Dominion WPS before for, you know, 20, 25 years.
If those nicknames are ever challenged again in the future, that school districts have a legitimate opportunity to keep them.
Why is it okay for my brothers and sisters who are Native American to be called redskin Indians or savages?
The absence of restrictions or any precautions aimed at preventing bloody confrontations between wolves and dogs continues to be a violation of Wisconsin animal cruelty law.
If there are some problems out there, a lot of times they don't surface right away. They might surface later.
I'm sitting on a road right now and the smoke is so thick that I'm going to turn around. I'm not going to drive any further for fear I'll run into somebody that I can't see.
Balloons were iced. They were flying at altitude and the birds became wet and then fell to the ground, you know, like missiles.
That was wildlife rehabilitator Marge Gibson at the end there talking about an ice storm in May that caused problems for migrating loons. On this frigid day, you've been listening to The Year in Soundbites as collected by the Wisconsin Public Radio News team. And wow, a lot happened this last year. Thanks to Chuck Kornbach for putting that together. This is Central Time. As many baby boomers find themselves having to maintain a full-time job while also caring for elderly parents, a lot of them are feeling the pinch. But what if there was a way to strike a balance between both responsibilities? Our next guest has one idea that might help, reducing the work week to 4 days. Richard Eisenberg is senior editor at nextavenue.org, a PBS resource for people over 50. He wrote an op-ed a little while back making the case for a 4-day work week. Richard, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks very much, Rob.
So can you describe what an ideal work week might look like to you?
Well, what I would love to see would be the ability for people who want to work 4 days a week rather than 5 days a week to be able to do so, still get their work done, but have that extra day so that they could do things that they need to do or want to do, things like taking their parent to the doctor or playing with their grandchildren or volunteering or just running errands, going to the cleaners, maybe traveling, maybe learning new skills. I just think that we could all use one extra day a week for ourselves.
Yeah, we mentioned this as baby boomers with elderly parents, but there are times where I'm, you know, nervous to try to make a doctor's appointment or dentist's appointment out in the future, you know, not having that day of the week. So it's something that would affect a lot of people.
Oh, absolutely. There was a study that came out recently that said that 45% of white-collar workers leave work sometimes to go to doctor's and dentist appointments. 52% leave to do things like buy gifts and greeting cards and flowers. And, you know, it makes sense. These are, you know, things people have to get done, and often they can't get done on the weekends. But you can imagine employers are not too crazy when their workers are leaving the office to go doing things. If they had the day off, there wouldn't be any kind of a problem.
It seems like there's two basic ways to accomplish this: reducing work hours, so maybe we work 4 8-hour days, or cramming those 40 hours into fewer days over the course of the week. Which are you leaning toward there?
Well, I'm not crazy about the system that some human resources people like to talk about, which is the compressed work week. And by that they mean basically working 10 hours a day for 4 days a week, so that you put in your 40-hour work week, you just do it in 4 days. And the reason I'm not crazy about that is that by the time you finish those 4 days, 10 hours a day, you're pooped. And so you don't have much energy to do anything on that fifth day, and I don't think that really solves the problem. What I'd much rather see is the ability for people to work 4 days a week at either 8 hours or maybe 9 hours a day, or maybe they work 5 days a week for 1 week and then 4 days the next, just so that nobody is feeling so exhausted by the time that fifth day comes around.
Yeah, I worked a 4-day, 10-hour-a-day schedule for about half a year. I was younger then. It was still pretty tiring. And I know my brother worked in a major printing plant in Wisconsin, and it had 3 days, 4 days, but it was 12-hour days. Mm. Yeah, I wouldn't recommend that.
Well, it's really punishing, and I don't think that it makes the workers productive, because you get to a point where you're just not as good after the 7th, 8th, 9th, 10th hour at work as you were the first few hours. And then that last day, you just need to sleep.
Definitely, definitely. Well, would we be paid, if we ended up doing this in a way that cut our hours, a lot of people might be suspicious of that because we'd presumably be paid less.
Well, you know, every employer that allows employees to do it, and I should say very few of them do, the numbers that I've seen show that only 7% of employers allow all of their workers, or most of them, to have a 4-day work week, and about a third of employers allow some of their workers to do it. But when it is allowed, it's all done sort of on a case-by-case basis, and it's worked out between the employer and the employee. And so in many cases, just as you say, it does mean a pay cut. In other cases, it doesn't. If you're still going to get the work done, some employers will say, you know, I don't really care, as long as the work is getting done. If you can do it in the 4 days instead of five, that's fine. What sometimes people find is that they take a pay cut, but they're able to keep all of their benefits. In some cases, they have to prorate their benefits also.
It sounds like there's an ad hoc approach out there for a lot of companies, where company A will talk to employee B and maybe work something out. Are you hoping for something more systemic for big employers?
Well, you know, I don't think there should be a law. I don't think any company should be required to do this. I just wish more employers and more managers would be more open-minded to the idea. Unfortunately, a lot of employers and managers say, no, we've never done that before, so we're never going to start doing it. Or how do I know we're going to get our jobs done here? And I wish they would be a little bit more open-minded, because I think that they would probably get better employees. When I talk to some employers who do have 4-day work weeks, they say that they find that it's a very great tool for them to attract employees and keep employees, because people like to work there and they like to stay there.
So whatever form it might take, having that option, not even a policy, but the option of flexibility, might result in better work from employees.
I think so. And so my advice for people who are thinking about doing this is to have a sit down with your boss and make the case for why you would like to do it, but more importantly, why it's going to be good for the employer, or at least why it's not going to be bad for the employer. Because the first thing your boss or your company is going to ask is, well, how can I be sure that the work is still going to get done? And what you need to do is make the business case for why they shouldn't worry about that.
Do you think that employers should be taking the lead on this? Not necessarily, if they're out there listening, not wait for the employees to take the lead?
I think that would be great. I would love to see that happen. I would love to see employers say to their employees, let's start this on a pilot basis. Let's try it out for 3 months and see how it works, or 1 month. Or I'm going to let anybody who's interested in this come and talk to me about it, and let's see if we can do it for people who want to. You know, there are some people who say, I don't want to do this. I've talked to some employers that offer this, and some of them, there are certain employees who just don't want it. They want to work 5 days a week. That's the way they like to work, and that's fine. So I don't think it should be mandatory for the employer. I don't think it should be mandatory for the employee. I just wish more businesses and employers, nonprofits, would allow this and more employees would take advantage of it.
We're talking with Richard Eisenberg. He's senior editor at nextavenue.org. That's a PBS resource, by the way, for people over age 50. A lot of information there. He wrote a piece a while back about the idea of a four-day work week and a few different ways to approach that. Want to hear from you after the news. You can call in now. What do you think about this idea? Do you wish you had a four-day work week every week or every other week? What would you do with that extra day to get things done? Or if you're an employer, have you thought about this? Have you tried it? Have you rejected the idea? The number to call is 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can email us, talk@WPR.org. We'll pick up this conversation and take your calls after the news. I'm Rob Ferret. Stick around. There's more to come on Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, it's our Teach Me What You Know segment. This week, we get a lesson in ice fishing. Meanwhile, we're talking with Richard Eisenberg. He's editor at nextavenue.org. He makes the case for a four-day work week, giving us an extra day to get stuff done. Take care of older parents, for example, errands, make our own doctor's appointments. We hope you'll join the conversation with your thoughts. Do you want to have a four-day work week? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or if you're an employer, what do you think of the idea? Would you give it a shot if an employee asked you? 800-642-1234 or tweet us at @CentralTimeWPR. We'll go to the phones now. We have Dave in Lake Geneva with us. Dave, hi.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure. What's your question or comment?
My comment is most of the employers I've met through my life would be more apt to say, if you can get your work done in 4 days instead of five, then I'm not giving you enough work.
Ah, gotcha.
So, you know, and this ends up on the salary side of things. I've been salaried for over 15 years, and the premise is, we expect you to work more hours. That's why we give you salary.
All right. Thanks for the call, Dave. So, yeah, that's a question I could see employers asking. Why are we, if we could get 4 days and get it all done, why would we pay you for 5 days? Something like that, Richard.
Well, I'm sure there are employers who would say that. And I think, you know, the answer would be, it isn't the number of hours, it's the work that's going to get done and the work that you expect me to get done. And let me prove to you that I can get my work done in 4 days the way I can get it done in five right now. And maybe it means working a few extra hours, or maybe it just means me being a little bit more efficient. I do think that we're going to see a change in management over the next, say, 10 or 20 years as more millennials become the bosses, because that's the generation, if I can generalize a little bit, that tends to value their hours out of work, I think, a little bit more than baby boomers and people who are older than the baby boomers have. And I think they're going to take a little different tack, a little different point of view about the idea of you're not working hard enough.
And it seems like we've got this big glacier here of the stuck-in-the-middle generation, the people who are going to be working another 10, 20 years, maybe at a time when they thought they'd be retiring, and maybe with greater medical needs themselves, their parents living longer, and we're just not quite solving it. We're all making it up as we go. Do you see this as just part of that bigger issue?
I do, and that's why I feel like there's a lot of pressure on this generation, people in their 50s and 60s, because they're feeling pressured to get their work done, because their parents need some help, their kids may need some help. Sometimes it's financial, sometimes it's just spending time with them, doing things that need to get done. And I feel like something's got to give, and I feel like if we were to allow more people to have that extra day to take care of these other things, they'd be a lot happier.
Did you look at other countries in writing up this piece and see how they are approaching these issues?
Well, I can tell you this. We have a 40-hour work week on average. In some countries, the average work week is much less. In the Netherlands, they have a 29-hour work week. In Norway and Denmark, they have a 33-hour work week. And somehow they manage to get the job done. We buy products from those countries. Nobody's complaining about the products being inferior. So I feel like it must be possible if other countries are able to do it. The other thing I guess I'd mention is, this is now our second week in a row where we've had four-day work weeks because of the holiday, and somehow the world didn't come to an end.
But I don't know. It's hard to break that pattern. The 40-hour work week has been the norm, the 9-to-5 job for so long. Is our culture ready to change in that way?
I don't think it'll happen overnight. I don't know if it ever will, but I do think it is beginning to happen a little bit more. The numbers seem to be a little higher than they were a few years back. I feel like there's more of a chance that more employers and more employees will give it a shot.
We'll go back to our callers now. We've got Ted on the line, and he's in Milwaukee. Ted, hi, you're on the air.
Hi, how's it going? I have worked a four-day work week with a previous employer, and the way we did it was we worked 4 10-hour days. And there was a lot of pluses to it. One of them is that if there's a need for overtime, people are more willing to put in that fifth day rather than a sixth day, so they can still get at least 2 days off. And like the previous caller, I did work a salary job, and I gave it up because I was working 6 days a week on salary. So when you're working salary, like he said, they're just going to work the heck out of you as long as they can. And if you whatever you've got done, they're going to put one more thing on your plate to do. So I know employers can do it, and I think we're making a mistake in terms of thinking about 4 8-hour days. What we may want to consider is working 4 10-hour days.
Thanks for the call, Ted, and sharing your story. Richard, I know you're not super wild about the 4 10-hour day, at least as a norm for most people.
Well, that's right. I mean, aside from the fact that it's just hard to keep working that many hours, I'm not sure that – I don't think that's really fair for people with families, for one thing, because it means you have, next to no time to be able to spend with your children. You won't be there for breakfast. You won't be there for dinner. You get home late at night. So I know that that's one way to do it. I just don't think it's a great way to do it.
When you rewrote this piece back a couple months, did you get a lot of response from people saying, yeah, you're right, thank you for writing this? Or was there kind of a shrug like, yeah, that'd be nice, maybe someday?
No, I actually got mostly the former. I got a lot of people writing in saying, I so agree with you, I wish more companies would do this, or I'm doing it now and I love it. So most of the people that I heard from were people who were also agreeing with me. They were in favor of this idea. They just wish that it would be easier for them to find it. And one piece of good news, though, is that it's getting a little easier to find employers that will allow you to do this, because if you're looking for a job and you go to websites that have job postings, you can now look for job openings where they say flexible schedules or alternative schedules. You couldn't have done that 10 years ago. And if you go to websites like flexjobs.com and hourly.com, they're now, websites and companies that specifically say, we will allow you to do it, or we're looking for people who want to do this.
And why do you think more, and you've touched on this a little, why do you think more employers haven't been jumping on this yet? Or do you think it's going to start snowballing as job searchers are shopping around for flexible hours online?
Well, I think the reason we haven't seen more of them doing it is there are two things. One is, as your callers have said, a lot of managers want to see their employees in the office every day. I think it's the same reason why companies like Yahoo are saying to their employees, you can't work remotely, even though some of those people could get their jobs done just as well, if not better, remotely. So I think that's one thing. They just want the face time with their employees. The other is, it's harder for the managers to manage people with flexible schedules, and it's much easier for them to say, I know that everybody I have is going to, clock in at a certain time on Monday and clock out at the end of the day on Friday, and that makes their life easier. I don't think we're going to see this snowball, but I do think we're going to see this happening more and more as more people go into the workforce who say, I want to work the way I want to work. And I think their employers, in order to keep them, are going to have to be a little bit more understanding and come up with some ideas that will keep them.
Wayne in Eau Claire joins us now. Wayne, hi.
Hi. I'm an employer, a small construction company, and about 12 years ago, we started a job that was almost 18 months, and we had to drive 60 miles. So those were long days, and we worked 4 10s through that period, and the guys got subsistence pay for that as well, so they did get some compensation. I like it because there's only 4 days. We have to drag all the equipment out and the cords and and tools and put it back, they like it. They get 10-hour holidays paid. So whenever we have a Memorial Day, Labor Day, 4th of July, Thanksgiving, they end up with just a 3-day work week. So they've really worked. It's worked really well. I work on the job most of the time with them. I'm almost 60. I'm starting to feel 10 hours is a lot for me, but the other guys are loving it. So it's worked out really well for us.
Wayne, thanks a lot for sharing your story. And Richard, you say millennials may change this picture. How soon do you think that's going to happen, where that millennial cohort enters into the decision-making process and maybe reshapes what we think of as the work week?
Well, we're already seeing a good number of millennials becoming bosses, sometimes bosses for younger, older employees, and so there's some tension sometimes in the workplace. But I think that's just going to continue to happen just because of the demographics. So I would say, you know, if we talk again about this in 5 years or 10 years, I have a feeling that we're going to see more employers doing it because more millennials will be in charge, and they'll say, that's the way I want to run my place.
Richard, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thank you.
That's Richard Eisenberg, senior editor at nextavenue.org. It's a PBS resource for people over age 50. Coming up, we'll learn how to make the most out of winter as we learn how to ice fish. First, a look at the headlines with Kristen Durst. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Each week, we take some time to let someone with a particular expertise teach us what they know. Today, our guest is going to teach us how to make the most out of winter by picking up a new hobby, ice fishing. Ray Spitz joins us. He's an outdoor writer specializing in fishing. In fact, he says he's already been out ice fishing twice this season. Ray, welcome to Central Time.
Good to be here. Thank you, Rob.
Well, I'll ask, I'm going to blame a producer for the phrasing here. What got you hooked on ice fishing?
I got tired of paying so much for a Friday fish fry, so I decided to go out and get my own, and it's been somewhat successful over the years.
And why ice fishing in particular? What do you love about it?
Well, it's a wonderful opportunity for people, particularly families, for as far as I'm concerned, and kids, to really enjoy the bounty that we have in Wisconsin. We have 15,000 lakes, and as former Governor Thompson said, they all have fish. So when they're frozen, it costs very little to get out on the ice and just put your line in and hope for the very best.
I'm not a fishing guy myself. My kids have had some opportunities to go out fishing with friends, and they've loved it. If I was going to be interested in trying ice fishing them with them, but I didn't know how to get started, I didn't want to make a big investment, what would I do to give it a try for the first time?
Well, first of all, you'd have to get a fishing license, which, if you're a first-timer, is a whole $5 in Wisconsin.
Ooh,
for the first year.
Not bad.
And there are no license fees for kids under 16. So the first thing that you can say is that it's not going to cost you anything to get out there. Few people also know that throughout the state, in every county, DNR offices will loan, literally loan for no charge, fishing equipment. Some of them have ice fishing equipment. Some of them have just summer equipment, but it's a first come, first serve. You can keep it for a week, and it's an opportunity to get the equipment you need without spending any money.
And what's the basic rig? What's the minimum we need to go out ice fishing?
All right. I'd say you need a 5-gallon white pail that you've probably here in Madison. I've seen people sitting on in Lake Monona or Lake Mendota. You need a small little rig of concerning of a reel and a very small, short, for heaven's sake, fishing pole is what you'd call it, and a small hook, and you need some live bait, like I'm talking about panfish now. Live bait like what they call a wax worm or a spike, which is a little larva, or a small crappie, what they call a crappie minnow. And you have to have someone that has an ice auger. That is a gas-operated auger that'll drill the hole. They're usually about 8 inches wide, and then they drill through the ice. And if you don't have one, find a friend at work or a member of the family, or if necessary, even hire a guide. And, of course, you dress warm. And as far as ice safety is concerned, if you're not familiar with the water, I strongly urge everyone to go with someone who knows that particular water, because ice can be very deceiving. Or you can see a group of people who are sitting on these white 5-gallon barrels, and they'll be in an area where there are fish probably, and it's safe to get out on.
So a lot of people maybe have watched people out on the lake and thought, how is that fun? You're out in the cold all day waiting for the fish. Tell us the fun side of it. What do you get out of ice fishing?
One of the greatest thrills that you'll ever get is seeing a 5 or 6-year-old kid pull up a small fish. It can be a 3-inch perch, for that matter. And for the rest of that person's life, they're going to remember the first time mom and dad took me out and look at the trophy that I caught, and then he'll laugh at his own, showing his own kids. The other thing is that you literally commune with nature. Many times you will see eagles swoop down on lakes in Wisconsin to pick up discarded fish. You'll see deer. You'll see coyotes. And this is a continuous thing, and it's a wonderful opportunity to see the trees, enjoy the wind, if you want to call it that, and then have a cup of hot chocolate or a cup of coffee, and you've had a great time, and it doesn't cost you much.
When looking at ice fishing lakes in a lot of places, including Monona Bay, just a few blocks from here, they look like shanty towns. All the shanties spring up. What's the key to a good ice shanty?
Well, as long as it's got 4 walls and it'll keep the wind out. But I've been in, we want to call them ice shanties. These rigs sometimes are the look like something out of a mansion. In other words, groups of people will go out and put one of these shanties together, if you want to call it a shanty. And it's a wind protection, actually. And they can watch the Packers. They drill holes right in the side of the shanty. They'll have dinner there, and they'll just have a great time for the whole day, and they can stay out of the wind as well. The one thing I do want to point out is that when you see a water, even if it looks safe, that's why I keep telling people, don't go out unless you know someone who knows that particular water, or hire a guide. As an example, I fish quite a bit up in Eagle River. They've got 1,300 lakes in the area. They've got 28 joined lakes. That's the largest freshwater chain of lakes in the world. Now, I might have, over the years, fished 4 or 5 of those lakes. I don't know all 28. So I better have someone who knows the particular water that we're going out on to make sure the ice is safe.
So even the next lake over, even if this lake I know is safe, the next one, there might be a river running into it or something like that that keeps it from freezing as well?
You're right on target, Rob. Right on target.
So where do you find an ice fishing guide? Where do you start hiring somebody?
First of all, you can go to any bait shop in your particular area. They're going to have lists of names of competent local guides. And the nice thing about it is they provide everything. They provide shelter, they provide transportation, they provide the equipment, the bait and tackle, and they provide the knowledge of where the fish are, how they're biting, and what to use when you're fishing. Because there are panfish, you of course can go after Wisconsin's favorite game fish, the walleye, or northern. It's a whole ball of wax that's just never ending.
And do they teach you how to clean them too?
Well, they'll actually fillet them for you, and there's nothing more wonderful than if you can get a guide, and sometimes the wife will come along and prepare a shore lunch for you.
Ooh.
That's better than anything you've ever had. That is really Wisconsin living.
Well, walleye is my favorite fish to eat. Do you have a favorite way to cook up that walleye you catch?
The favorite way, if you want to do it quickly, my favorite way is to simply spread some butter in a pan, put perhaps a few seasonings on of your choice. It can be anything from salt and pepper to chipotles or whatever pleases you, and just cook them so that the flesh is starts to turn firm. Turn it over. It just takes a few minutes, and sit down, and you're in heaven. You can also, of course, deep fry them, but I find the sautéing better when you're in a hurry or something that you want to do right on the ice.
That's pretty simple. I seem to remember my grandma making panfish basically the same way you just described.
Exactly. And there is, people always ask me, what tastes best? Believe me, Rob, they're all wonderful. Walleye, sauger, which is, and perch. They're all member of the perch family. Walleye's the largest. Sauger, you don't have that many of them in Wisconsin, but they are available, and perch. Then there are crappies, bluegills, and pumpkin seed as panfish. one is as good as the other. There is nothing better than that fish.
So with your license and assuming you're lucky, how many fish can you take in an outing or a season?
That's an excellent question. Generally, here are the general rules. You're allowed per day to catch and possess 25 panfish. That's perch, bluegills, pumpkin seed, and crappies. You're allowed to catch per day 5 walleye and 5 northern. However, there's a caveat to that. There are many, many, many lakes in Wisconsin, particularly in what is called the ceded territory. That's about the top third of the state, where the Native Americans have agreements with the DNR and with the government and the state government and the federal government regarding their ability to, in the spring, to spear the walleye and muskie. And so those lakes, the DNR arrives at a limit on particular lakes in those areas and in other areas where you cannot catch as many as the normal regulations provide. Some of the lakes in the north, you can catch 2 or 3 walleye. Some of the lakes, you can catch 5. On some of the rivers, of course, like the mighty Wisconsin in the Mozanie area, you can catch 5. It varies, is what I'm saying. So when you use the general term of daily limits, just remember that those limits are changing tremendously all the time.
So it sounds like for a variety of reasons, checking in on maybe the DNR website is a good first stop.
That is an excellent first stop, and that'll also tell you where the counties are where you can literally borrow the fishing equipment, Rob, and have fun with your kids.
Well, Ray, can you share some of your best places where you've had great ice fishing experiences around Wisconsin?
Okay. I can. Now, this doesn't mean that there aren't 1,000 of these places. I'm just telling you the ones that I particularly have enjoyed. I like to fish the Eagle River area because of the natural beauty and because of the fact that they have such a wide variety of fish. They have them all, the walleye, northern, and all the panfish. And I particularly like to fish the 28 Lake chain. Then I enjoy fishing the Wisconsin River in the Mozanie area. They have tremendous opportunities. I caught the largest northern pike I've ever caught in my life through the ice on the Wisconsin River near Mozanie with a guide, friend of mine. It was 39.5 inches.
Wow.
And, of course, we released it. As I always tell people, take enough for a frying pan and throw the rest back or release the rest, especially if they're large. And then the other place is I lived in the Clam Lake area in the midst of the Chequamegon National Forest. That's where the elk herd is, about 33 miles east of Hayward. And the Hayward area has the flowages and lots of great lakes. So those are the three places that I am more familiar with, although I fished in many, many others. And I just want people to know that I am not particularly saying this place is better than the other, because they're all good.
And Ray, just briefly, what is your next outing? Do you have something on the plans?
I plan to go back to Eagle River in a week or so. The best fishing of the year, most guides will tell you, is what they call early ice, the first few weeks of the ice. And then in the end, sometime in March when the water starts to warm, that's another good period, particularly for panfish like crappies. They come up in the water column and are oxygenated. And so I'm just going to go there and see what my luck's going to be again with a couple of friends. I know the area pretty well, and that's what I'm looking forward to.
Well, good luck, and thanks for joining us, Ray.
It has been a pleasure. Thank you, Rob.
That's Ray Spitz. He's an outdoor writer specializing in fishing. News from NPR is next. Then our next guest tells us why she started her own Philosopher's Dinner Club. I'm Rob Ferret. More to come here on Central Time.